Olle Damegård is with us. This is the third part of our series on the assassination of Olof Palme. And this is the second hour. We're going to continue to tie into this murder. Other aspects, of course, this spirals out into consequent tragedies and crimes. It's an effort, I think, to take out further people that have been involved, as we mentioned before. It's like an ongoing cover-up that basically never ends. This criminal network that we've been talking about are so embedded in lies and crime that their activities just can't stop. This is something they need to continue to do as more and more people both get up to speed of what's going on in positions of power and outside as well. So basically one thing connects to another. And what we're going to do in the second then, Ole, is to talk about the Estonia catastrophe. And you can approach this from any angle you want. I know that you have a lot of interesting things to tell us about this. So take it away, Ole.
Yeah, what I would like to do is just tell the official story of what is supposed to have happened, if anyone doesn't remember. It was on the 27th of September, 1994, that's 8 years after the assassination. There was an Estonian ferry called MS Estonia who left the harbor of Tallinn in Estonia, the country Estonia, with about 1,000 passengers. They left in the evening, and the weather was a bit rough, but there was no real storm. And they left going towards Sweden. What happened was that more or less midway in between Sweden and Estonia, there was Mayday signals called out, Mayday, Mayday, we're going under. And very quickly after that, the ferry disappeared and sunk after midnight. And about officially 852 people drowned that night. It was a very, very awful, awful incident that affected people in many different countries. And I know in Sweden, I think it's every fourth family or something like that was somehow affected by this disaster. Mm. So it was a very, very big trauma for Sweden.
Yeah, I remember it clearly, by the way, when they made the announcements on the TV, and they were pulling up all the names and everything. You know, as usual, it's like it is with these kinds of events in Sweden. It's very hushed up and almost to a point of where it's very contrived and, of course, traumatizing. I understand that. But it's, as usual, it's very little that ever gets out about it. Very little is known. And, of course, as we'll get into, there's many reasons of that. But it's but I remember it clearly when it happened. I wasn't that old at that stage. So, yeah.
No, like I said, this was 8 years after the Palme assassination. I was very much involved in trying to find out these things. So when this happened, I mean, it was the biggest marine disaster since the Second World War, I think, in Northern Europe or the whole of Europe.
Yeah, wow.
And it was a big thing. But just like with the Palme assassination, in the beginning, I had absolutely no idea that there could be anything than an accident. They say, the official version say that the weather got really bad, that it was high waves, and that the bow visor, you know, the thing that opens up where the cars can drive in, that was torn off the ship and causing enormous amount of water coming inside the ferry. And that was the one, the cause of the whole thing, that made the ship tip to the side and then sink down. But like with all of these things, it's like I've always used what I call Farmer Brown logic. You know, like even if somebody comes out with a fancy white coat and a long title, if you say 2 times 2, it's still 4. It doesn't matter if they say it's 315 and they can explain it with some 3D animation type of thing. It still doesn't make sense. And I always go for the logic thing. There is a certain logic to choose, and it's very simple most of the time. With this marine disaster, right away there were very big question marks in the way that the authorities were handling it and so on. So on a very early stage, I started looking into it, and the question marks just kept piling up, because one of the things was that when you started hearing what the witnesses were saying, people were right away were talking about that there had been explosions on board. They were around midnight, about 6 hours after they left harbor. There were some massive bangs and the whole ship shook like this. After that, the ship started going very fast forward. It speeded forward and people were like, the band stopped playing and people were just falling all over the place because it was in such high sea. And also people heard that it was like somebody was using a big sledgehammer knocking on metal, and there was hydraulic machines like from the Bauweiser that was trying to like trying to open it, but they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what people also saw was that water came from underneath, underneath the water level, which is impossible if the hull is complete. And also the way that the ferry sank, it went down. Once it was lying on the side, it just took minutes for it to go down. Even though it's a massive, massive big ferry, the amount of air that it's trapped in it will keep it there floating. What can happen is it can turn upside down, but without a hole in the hull letting water in, the ship would just keep floating for days and then slowly, slowly sink. Here instead, it went down within minutes, taking hundreds of people down with it. So right away, the Swedish government, they were just changing prime minister, Ingvar Carlsson and Carl Bildt were changing positions. And both of them went out and said, oh my God, this is such a disaster. We will see to it that right away, everybody, all the corpses, all the dead people would be taken out of the wreck so that they can get a proper burial. Because there was, I can't remember how many people were saved, but it was less than 100 people were saved out of these 1,852 is the official number of people who went down this night.
Do you know how many survivors?
I have it here somewhere.
It should be fairly few, I think. I mean, this is in
yeah, it was
November.
Very few.
It was cold as hell in the water, of course. September, I think it was, right?
Yeah. But what happened was that first they said, we're going to do everything and get all the dead bodies up. Then overnight, suddenly they totally changed the approach to this. And they said, no, we're very, very sorry, but there's no way we can get the dead back. The ship is only on a 70-meter depth, you know, so it's no problem. Almost an amateur diver can go down there. But instead, the whole place was surrounded by big military ships and just saying, back off, nobody is allowed here. So that right away made me sort of like, whoa, wait a second, something is very strange here. Also, the Swedish marine rescue teams and so on, I mean, Sweden is a high-tech country. Here, once again, like with many of the other conspiracies, we see that there's a very big delay. Just like in all of these big conspiracies, normal activity does not happen, you know. And here there was a delay between 4 and 5 hours, 4 to 6 hours before people could be rescued, because they said the helicopters were not in working condition. And it just took hours and hours. And these poor people were in this ice cold water, dying. So, but what came forward was that they wanted to, instead of take all the dead bodies out of the ship, they started talking about that they wanted to cover the whole ship with concrete.
Yeah.
With concrete. We're talking like a Swedish billion Swedish krona to do that. And everybody was like, but why? No, because it's a sanctuary and to keep it safe from grave plunderers and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, that you should put up minefields around normal cemeteries in that case with barbed fence and armed guards, I would say.
Yeah, I remember some of the lingo they used at the time was that they wanted to like preserve the peace as a, you know, around this as a tomb, yeah. and they wanted to build a whole sarcophagus yeah. basically of concrete yeah. around it. Crazy.
Yeah, and this is what it's still today. Nobody has been allowed to go down there and take these corpses. But also when you see how the survivors were treated, we get there's more of these strange things. When she went down, she had been going straight off course. She went a lot more southwest than she was supposed to do. And there were other ferries going this night as well. And MS Mariella was one of them. They said, what is going on? This captain is like, he's acting like he's crazy and he's just taking off, you know. So they followed when they heard the Mayday shout going out. And so they went there with other ferries as well, trying to rescue the people, but very few was in the water. The few that they got on board were, as soon as they got into Swedish territorial waters, helicopters with Swedish, nobody knows who they were, but they were said that they were Swedish police, but they were like the Men in Black, but the Swedish version. They came, and all the survivors were sort of put in a separate, they weren't allowed to mingle with the other passengers. They were put aside. They were almost treated like criminals. They weren't allowed to speak to anyone. They weren't allowed to make any phone calls. They were not allowed to go to the toilet without escort and these things. Then when they came into the harbor, they were kept back for almost an hour, even though many of them were injured. And they were held back while all the other cars and all the other passengers left the ship. Then they were taken off and taken to the Huddinge Hospital in Sweden. And in the Huddinge Hospital, there again, they were treated like criminals. They were held totally separate. They weren't, and when they were allowed to make phone calls, they had to give all the personal ID information of the receiver of the call, as well as of themselves and so on. So they were treated very strangely. Anyway, after a few days, there were a lot of question marks around the list of survivors, because people were rescued and came up on the list of the survivors. And then there were especially 9 crew members, one the second in charge, the captain. There were 2 captains on the boat this evening. His name was Abu Peet. This guy was rescued. He was registered as being rescued by a helicopter. He was filmed by a German film team, and he was also seen and filmed in an ambulance in Sweden when he took off to the hospital. Right. And there were 9 crew members from Estonia. These crew members, they were both female and male. They were first on the list, and the families were informed that no problem, they're safe, and don't worry, they've been sent this, they've been sent here, they've been sent there, and so on. These 9 members suddenly disappeared. The families never found out what happened to them, and suddenly their names appeared on the list of the dead people. Which caused a lot of confusion around for these families, because people have seen them alive. People have there were some crew members that had talked to other crew members in the hospital, and then suddenly their beds were and they disappeared, never to be heard of again. And there was another man who he was said to have survived. They showed exactly, you know, there were even doctors had his temperature and all of these what do you call it when you check that you're okay, and the physicals, everything of that was mm-hmm. there. Yeah. And they said, no, he's been flown to this hospital in Finland, and then he was in Tallinn, and so the family was trying to track him down, and then suddenly he turns up dead, and they're like very confused and in absolute deep sorrow. But they asked, please, we need to have the body. So the body was sent in a coffin from Sweden. And at the ceremony, the wife insisted on opening the coffin. And when they opened the coffin, then the body of this crew member, his name was Vatras, was totally tortured. He was stabbed in the throat. He was blue, and he was hit. You know, it looked like he'd been hit with a lot of different hard objects, and all bloody and awful. When they approached the authorities and said, "My God, what happened here?" The official story was that he had been in the seawater for hours, and the rocks had been so sharp that they had cut his face like that. But when you looked at his clothes were fine all the way up to the neck, where they were all filled with blood and so on. So that doesn't make sense in my world. If somebody lies in the water for hours, up and down against the rocks, his clothes would not be, there would be no blood on the clothes at all. Mm. And they would be ripped as well, but they were fine. There was nothing.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, that's one of them. I wanted to also just ask you a little bit about, if we zoom out for a minute, why they would want to cover up the wreck. It's a big one, of course, but the various governments of the countries involved are extremely paranoid, I should say, about letting anybody near the wreck. Despite this, there have been several, quote-unquote, illegal, attempts to do this, and there's even private adventures. An American, I think, what was his name? Greg Bemis, I think his name was. His crew, they dove down there to film the damage. Yeah. They actually recovered pieces of metal and everything. Yeah. How much do you know about this? Tell us about this and why they want to cover up the stuff.
Yeah, what has come out, has leaked out, is that at this time, Estonia, the ferry, was part of an international smuggle route for weapons on a very high level. I believe we're talking about the same network that the Iran-Contras were involved in, and also the Bofors Hervan, the big scandal about Bofors, where weapons have been moved between countries up and down and sold illegally to nations at war, which is very much part of the Palme assassination as well. It's entangled with, it's like a spider web of these things. And at this time, this was just when the Soviet Union had gone down and dissolved. And there was an American colonel called Alexander Einzel. He was an Estonian by birth, and he was sent from the States to Estonia to lead, become the commander-in-chief of the Estonian army at that time, to lead, because the Russian troops were withdrawing back and leaving a lot of their military equipment behind and so on. And Estonia was suddenly a free country and needed to build up their own strength. In just south of Tallinn, there was a U-boat, submarine U-boat base called Paldinski. And you had nuclear power submarines in there that they, with Swedish help as well, foreign nations went in there and dismantled these different military stations, and also this Paldinski submarine installation there. Mm-hmm. This particular evening, when the accident happened, the so-called accident, there were two trucks, witnesses saw two trucks coming with military escort. They were the last two that was driven on board on Estonia this evening. There were even delays for quite a long time just because of these two trucks. And they were parked nearest to the bow visor in the front of the Estonia. When the ferry took off this evening, there was quite a few witnesses saw that together with these trucks, there was a man in a red blazer who had a document briefcase with a, what do you call it, attached to his arm, like with a handcuff type of thing. Mm-hmm. And he was talking a lot with the captain. He was sitting with the captain at the table while they were having dinner and so on. And when they came to the point where, when they were way out at sea, when suddenly these explosions were heard, people said that the captain looked really scared, and he and this guy in the red blazer connected to the two trucks, they ran up to the commando bridge. And that was after that when they started speeding up. It has been exposed now that these two trucks had high-tech weaponry and also different type of radioactive material. They were loaded with that. There's different theories about what was there, and this radioactive material is said to have been one of the things. It's a battery for a satellite, a battery that can change the mirrors, the sun mirrors on a satellite. This is highly radioactive material, and it is said that the reason why they wanted to cover the whole ship over with concrete, in my opinion, was because of radioactive, to cover it up because of fear of radioactive leakage. And also the company that they hired to do this, to cover it up with concrete and to go down and dive, it was a Dutch company that was a specialist in clearing up radioactive waste.
I mean, the wreck is monitored, I think, pretty much permanently now by radar, by the Finnish Navy, to try to prevent someone from going down there. And just to emphasize that point as well, there have been both Swedish and Estonian, government investigations that both confirmed that military equipment has been aboard, the ship on numerous occasions. And then they try to claim, well, we don't know if it was part of it that particular trip or whatnot. But nonetheless, the ship was used for this. And Stephen Davis, who actually wrote for the New Statesman, also claimed that laboratory tests had confirmed that there was an explosion in the metal. And he also speculated the ship was actually used, to carry secret cargo of military equipment that was smuggled, well, as he says, from the Russians by the British MI6 on behalf of the CIA. Whether that's correct or not, I don't know. But there's more going on here than people know. That's for sure.
That is absolutely spot on, I would say. But this is after years and years of very intense investigations. But this is not as something they have easily come forward with.
Yeah.
And also, just a few weeks after the accident, or just days after, there were a team of divers, official divers down there. And what they filmed was, when they filmed the hull of the ship, they actually filmed explosive that was attached to the hull with metal plates, I think magnetic plates, like that. Mm-hmm. There were two sets of explosives. When the divers go down there again in December, like a month later, these explosives are removed. Not a trace of them. And TV4 in Sweden went out with these films where you can clearly see these packages, and even military experts have identified what type of explosives and so on. But when I saw that, when then the TV4 news went public with this, I thought, oh, finally, now they're going to get, it's going to come out in the open.
Right.
But not one newspaper the day after, not one newspaper mentioned it at all.
No.
There was no reaction whatsoever, just denial. And then when people on the commissions and people, the politicians involved, which are, quite a few of them are Bilderbergers, by the way. Mona Sahlin and Ines Uusmann, and Carl Bildt.
That's right.
When they were confronted with this, and other experts as well, they said that, well, we are aware of the explosives, but we can't see the importance of looking into that, because we need to keep to what we can actually prove and to look. We can't see that there's any relevance.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
That's pathetic.
We're talking about explosives.
Well, furthermore, if this is something radioactive, it's a continuing, ongoing crime, because people are being hurt by this. I mean, it all depends, of course, what type of radiation, how much it is, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But as we know, nothing of it is good. So it needs to be done something about it. What do you think? What kind of amounts are we talking about?
I don't know, but I know that it's been cleaned up. They stopped talking about this whole concrete type of thing, and when they started letting go of that one, by then it had been cleared up. So I don't think that is a problem at all.
Do you think there have been secret operations then to perform this the cleaning job here, or how did they pull that off?
Yeah, big time. I have a friend who's a sea captain on a cargo ship that passes that, and he said there's been so many strange ships around that site, so many times, military ships, all kinds of weird ships with equipment on, and yes, for sure, they cleaned it up a long time ago. Also, if you remember, years before that, there was another ferry catastrophe in Sweden with a ship called Jan Helvelius. It was a Polish ship that went from the south of Sweden, from Ystad down to Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And that ship, the ferry, it went out in a storm, a really, really awful storm, where no other captains went out. It was only that one. That captain, for some reason, insisted on going out, and the ship went on its side, and then on top, you know, it started floating like that, and it was left like that, I think, for days before it actually sank down.
Mm-hmm.
A year or so later, there was a lot of problems for the families of the dead truck drivers, because they were never given the insurance money, because the insurance companies never accepted that it was an accident. So the money was never paid out. Mm. And when amateur divers went down there some years afterwards, they found that there were holes cut in the side of the ferry on the bottom of the sea, where whole trucks had been lifted out. Whole trucks.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking like 18-meter vehicles that had just been lifted out. Now, you tell me who can do a thing like that if not on a very, very high level. And also, if I remember right, they didn't let the ferry sink where it was, because it was quite near the coast. So
it
was
dragged it out.
It dragged out, and then it sank there. So it was so that, in my opinion, they could do it without having nosy people seeing what was going on.
Yeah. Wow. So we had another one, a German journalist, by the way, Jutta Rabe, who wrote the, you know, a book about this called, I think it's just called
wonderful.
The Estonia.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. And if people want to get a just quick, I guess, overview of her ideas and theories about this, they made a movie, Baltic Storm, it was called, released back in 2003, that people can look at. And it goes into some of this, you know, ideas here about covering up. But what do you think otherwise was might have been on there weapon-wise, and was it... Who was it shipped to, or who was shipping it? Can we just clarify that a little bit?
It was, once again, it's very difficult to get grips of this because it's on a very, very high level. But it was done with the approval of Sweden, the Swedish Trafiksäkerhetsverket, the Board of Traffic Security or whatever, was waiting for this cargo in Sweden and was supposed to escort these two trucks through Sweden and down through them. And I think, as far as I've been able to find out, that this was a very regular transport with normal people had no idea, but this was occurring all the time, that they were shipping weaponry from the east to the west and then selling it, going out on all these different smuggle routes to different areas. But what I just wanted to say, that you know, when you look at other big conspiracies, very often there's a drill going on of the exact same events that is actually occurring. You remember it happened in 7/7 in London, the London bombings.
Yep.
There was a drill going on where the exact subway station and a bus was, in this scenario, was supposed to be hit by terrorist bombs going off at the exact same time as they actually happened. There were also several drills going on in around 9/11 with NORAD and other things happening exactly the same. So people who were doing their jobs were very confused. Is this a drill or is it a real event? And also when you look into it, it gets very confused because you don't know what you're looking at. What is real and what was the drill? It also happened in Norway before the mass shootings, the day before they had drills there. And it happened on the morning in Oklahoma City before the bomb went off there. The bomb squad was there doing their drill and so on. So that is a thing that occurs again and again. So I looked into that. And on the day before the accident or this disaster, what happened? They had a mock bomb exercise on Estonia with bombs placed at exactly the same spot where the holes were later, you know, in the sauna and swimming pool area. And there were in 1994, the year this happened, there were two of these bomb exercises where Swedish police and the RITS, it's the Sweden Marine Fire and Rescue Agency, went to Tallinn and had these mock bomb exercises on Estonia. And the exercise was that there had been bomb placed on the different locations in the ship, and that some bombs were supposed to be found by bomb sniffer dogs, and then the ship would go out and actually sink in the middle, right between Sweden and Estonia, which is exactly where it sank. Okay, so here we are again, that there's a drill of the exact same scenario to what happened, what actually happened. And one other thing with this drill was that they used a coded fire alarm in the exercise, where they called Mr. Skylight to number one and two. This message meant that the firefighters were supposed to go to two different locations on board and put out fire. Mm-hmm. And witnesses on board this night heard exactly that in the PA system, Mr. Skylight to number one and two. Okay. So what we're talking about is also, I need to continue, because what very few people know is that when this happened, it was the first day of a 10-day NATO naval exercise called Cooperation Venture 94. And there were more than 15 ships and a number of maritime aircraft and submarines involved. The countries were, let's see, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, United Kingdom, the USA, and also Baltic partner nations of like Russia, Sweden was part of it, Poland, and Lithuania.
What was it called again? Sorry?
It was called Cooperative Venture 94.
94, okay, yeah.
And it was when this accident happened, or this disaster happened, it was the first day of this 10-day naval exercise, NATO naval exercise. And it was all staged in Skagerrak, the sea between Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. So it was not in the Baltic Sea, but it's like less than an hour away from, if you fly, it's less than an hour to get to the actual site where all these people drowned. Hmm. But did they take any part of this? Because Sweden officially was, the helicopters was very ill-equipped and there were all these technical problems. So why, if you have like 14 like 14 nation exercise going on the other side of Sweden with all the high tech equipment and all type of planes and submarines and ships, and why did they not go and help out, you know?
Mm, yeah, the exercise, the original one, not the NATO one here that you mentioned then, but the previous one with the bombing and all that, was that just the Swedish police and or military, or was it like a joint operation between different countries as well?
The mock bomb exercise was just Sweden and Estonia.
Okay, yeah.
And Sweden had, the Swedish police had required to take part of it. So they had practiced exactly this same scenario in February and then the day before the accident or the disaster in September. So they should be really spot on and everything like so smoothly working. But can I also say that after the bombs went off on board, it took almost an hour before the Mayday signals were sent out. And during this hour, the ship was going very fast forward and leaving its course, like I said, about 15 kilometers going southwest. So they were totally in a place where they would not be found, which could seem very strange if you wanted to be rescued.
Yeah.
Like I said, it seems like the captain when the bombs went off, the captain got scared because he must have known about these transport things and the weaponry and so on. So it seems like he got scared and ordered full speed ahead to try and get to shore as soon as possible. But in the meantime, since this, if the, these trucks and the truckloads were discovered, that could start a global scandal on a massive scale, because it could expose this whole network, you know, just like how the Iran-Contra scandal was exposed.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way, so he needed to. They needed to get rid of these two trucks, and this is what it seems like. What happened? What people were hearing was that the when you look at where these explosives were placed, it looked like half of the bow visor was blown off on one side,
mm-hmm.
and that they were trying to open it so that they could dump these two trucks, get them overboard, but they couldn't get the bow visor up, so they were not hitting it with sledgehammers to try and get it up. And these hydraulic sounds were to try and lift it. And some people say that they might have been able to get one of the trucks overboard by pushing it over with the second truck, but I don't know that for sure.
Hmm. I wanted to just ask you a little bit why, and I guess we're coming to that as well, but why this one did sink then, if this was a quote-unquote regular weapons transport as they've been doing so many times before. There has to be something more here of who was on the ferry and you know, how it connects to the assassination of Palme, pretty much.
Yeah. I'll get to that shortly. Just before that, what happened was that, like I said, for about an hour, she was speeding ahead, trying to get to shore or to a decided destination. I don't know why she went to exactly that spot off route, but the exact same spot as the drill. But when she finally understood that we're going under here, the captain started sending out the Mayday, Mayday, we're going under here. And right after that, this Mayday signal was jammed, and the whole VHF channel 16 and channel 2182, which were all the communication with Estonia, was just jammed. There was a jamming signal that just blocked it. And at the same time, all radio communication and telephone communication on the southern coastline of Finland just went down.
Hmm.
And it was jammed exactly from when she disappeared, when this whole thing started, when she started sinking, until she went under the surface. Then this blockage were lifted. If you look at other things like similar things with conspiracies, when 9/11 happened, the whole system of mobile phones and TV, all of these were jammed as well in New York, mm. around that side. And they said that was because the antennas were on top of one of the buildings. But that's absolutely not true. That wouldn't block it. Also, when Kennedy was assassinated, the whole telephone system, on a national scale, went down for one whole hour.
Hmm.
Okay, so this is again a similarity.
Interesting.
So now we get to what we were talking about before. One thing that I've had big problems understanding is like, okay, there was a transport of this weaponry and radioactive material, and there was this network of smuggling routes and so on. But the Russian mafia was involved in this, as well as the CIA, the MI6, and the Swedish authorities and so on. But why would they place a bomb there? It doesn't make sense.
No.
The cover-up makes sense, but not the bomb. And also, why did not Ingvar Carlsson and Carl Bildt, why did they not know about this if it had been... I mean, how could they go out and say, we're going to rescue everybody, and then they were informed, no, we can't touch it because of the radioactive.
They were not in the loop.
They were not in the loop at that point. But, so the question is, who placed this bomb? You know, because it wasn't in anyone's interest, really, except for the public, to stop this. On the contrary, they were making billions out of it on both sides.
Yeah, and this would expose them then, as you said, and that would be more dangerous for them. So what's your thoughts?
My thoughts are that there have been a lot of problems with the number of dead people here. They changed up and down, and the numbers, they've never been able to put the exact number of people that were on board this or who died. And there was an article in Helsingborgs Dagblad that in 2004 they said that there's about 69 people here that we can't fit in. They were not on the official list of dead people, and now suddenly they're here. It differs of 69 people. That's quite a lot of people. So I started tracking down this number, and this number of around 70 people kept popping up. And right after the accident, the hours after it happened, which is always when that is the time to get real information, because as soon as the days passes by after a thing like this, they shut it down. All the evidence is cleaned away, so it's very hard to find out. But just hours after, it was reported that there was a group of 70 police, senior policemen from Stockholm that was on board this ship. And they went to Tallinn on a course from the police union. There's a researcher called Christopher Bolling, and I think he's English. He's really good.
He's American, but I think, actually.
Is he American?
Yeah. Well,
as far as I know, he and his family later disappeared, but he was very much active in trying to find out what happened. And he claims that these 70 police were involved in this drill, the bomb drill, that they were over there taking part of this, and all of them were on the way back home when Estonia went down, and only between 3 and 5, depending on who you listen to, survived this. But the more I look into it, this group in 1994, it was, like I said, 8 years after the assassination of Olof Palme, and more evidence was coming out that the Swedish police were involved, and there were parts of the SÄPO, the security police, were involved in the assassination and so on. And especially a program called Striptease were very spot on, and they kept pushing, revealing embarrassing things around this. This is a theory, and I hope I don't mean to cause any harm to any of the victims' families and so on, but I think this is a theory that I've never heard about, so I'm just going to put it forward because in my world, it makes sense. In that central police community, there must have been a lot of rumors and knowledge going on, and people also involved in the assassination itself. And in a group like this, if you want to get rid of a whole group of people, how can you do that without it being noticed? It's like if you want to get rid of 70 people, if you have 70 car accidents where all of the people come from the same group, or 70 people die of cancer in the same little group, or so it's tricky. So on an international scale, if you look at this type, one way they do it is they whatever the target is, they put him on a passenger plane or somewhere where there are hundreds of other people, so that, like with the Lockerbie, for instance, where the real target was Olof Palme's colleague Bernt Carlsson, who knew a lot about the Palme assassination. So they placed a bomb in his luggage, and when the plane blew up, there was about 270 people, I think, that died. And to this day, there are all these theories. What was the reason? Who was the target? And so on. Mm. That is so. But if you want to get rid of a whole group of people, like 70 people, you need to disguise it in a massive scale, for instance, among 1,000 people.
Indeed.
So I believe that what happened was that you got these people on board, them not knowing. Some of them were part of this mock drill, but not knowing. Only a very few people, you know, the one who's in charge of the bombs, know that it's a real one or a fake one. You know, they did that in the World Trade Center. Also, they supplied what was supposed to be fake bombs, but there were actual real bombs, mm-hmm. active bombs, and so on. So I think this was a way of getting rid of this group of people once and for all. And the people who did that had no idea about these weapon transport things and made a massive mess of the whole thing on a big scale.
So they didn't know that they should have or could have chosen another boat, another vessel that potentially wouldn't be so risky and cause all these consequent problems, basically.
But nobody knew about these consequent problems because they weren't aware of these trucks. And also these trucks, there is a possibility that they were not supposed to be on board. If you remember, the ferry was delayed for almost an hour, I think, before these trucks came aboard. And very often in these big conspiracies, you know, that somebody messes up, somebody doesn't know what's going on and make a problem for the rest of the operation. And this could be what happened here. This could also be why when the NATO troops or the naval operation was going on, that why they jammed the signal, because they knew about this whole weapon thing. And also why the whole, or if they were the ones responsible for putting the bombs there, there could be several reasons here. I'm speculating here. Mm-hmm. That they wanted to get rid of the people involved in the Palme with too much knowledge about the Palme assassination, but at the same time also get rid of the crew of Estonia, because there were families have reported that these nine crew members that disappeared, that some of them were under a lot of stress, you know, a lot of pressure, and whistleblowers are always very dangerous. You know? So there is a possibility that these two trucks were not supposed to be on board and that the ship was supposed to go down, and that was it, with the crew, with the Palme. They very often take care of more than one thing at the same time.
Sure, yeah. So were these primarily police officers then that they targeted, or were they of any other profession, and do we have any names here? Or
I have not been able to get any names. I would very much like to know if anyone has been able to identify them, because like I say, they were not on the list of the 852. They came later on, and in the first report, just hours after the incident, they were called senior officers from Stockholm. Mm-hmm. Then later, they were not educated as police officers, but they were like administrative, staff from the police.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Not educated as police officers. Are we talking security police or secret, whatever?
So we don't know who was taken out or, but potentially for what reason. How do you think that they got all of these people on board?
Very simple. Like, you arrange a conference this is how it's done very often. You try to get as many on board, like a helicopter, like they did with the Polish government or something, like get them on one plane or one boat or one train and then blow it up. Getting them out there is not such a big problem. And I mean, who could have ever imagined that they would sink a ferry?
Yeah.
But that would also explain why they jam the signal, why all the communication goes down for all this time, why the rescue operation is delayed, because they want to make sure that everybody is dead. You know, it will also explain why the crew members that knew something were kidnapped, because Sven Arnér, the researcher, has been able to track down what happened with these people as well. It seems like they were held, they were taken from the hospitals, and at least Arvo Pete, the captain, this captain Arvo Pete, he was held in a villa somewhere outside Uppsala in the northeast of Stockholm, and then the day after this incident, there were two private jets that came, paid for by the U.S. Embassy in Stockholm. According to this Swedish journalist, Sven Arnér, who is like a pit bull terrier, he just never gives up, he managed to track down that there was two private jets that came to Arlanda on the day afterwards. And one was a Boeing 727-200 with registered number VRCLM, and it belonged to Larmark Aviation Cayman Limited. This came, it's a 161-seater, I mean, it's not a small plane. It arrived from Amsterdam on the evening of the 27th of September without passenger and left the next evening with four unregistered passengers headed for Amsterdam. This one is owned by Lars Erik Magnusson, a Swedish real estate mogul. Do you know him? I think they had a TV program about him, the unknown billionaire of Sweden,
mm-hmm.
who's involved in very much sort of big business. He also invested heavily in an oil and gas scheme in Turkmenistan the same year. The other plane came from it belonged to International Lease Finance Corporation, ILFC, from Los Angeles. It's a Gulfstream 4 with a register number N971L, and it belonged to a company called AIG, owned by ILFC, with one of the members was Morris Greenberg, who's one of the in the elite as well. And both of these planes, the second one left with five unidentified passengers. Both of them were paid for by the U.S. Embassy in Stockholm.
Hmm.
And I know there's been quite other scandals in Sweden where people have been abducted, taken and from Arlanda and taken abroad by the American NSA
or CIA
against all international laws, human rights and all of these things,
yeah.
and flown out and disappeared, and tortured, killed, you name it.
Yeah, that's right. They've been extradited pretty much, and Swedish authorities have been playing ball, as they say. It reminds me also a little bit, Ulle, of, when the Titanic happened, they had this kind of, those who missed it list, famous people who, were slated to go on the ship, but just kind of in the last few minutes or other circumstances happened, so they bailed out, like J.P. Morgan was one of them, yeah, Milton yeah. Hershey, Henry Clay Frick, Alfred Vanderbilt, John R. Mott, and some other folks. I wonder if there's any else in this case of the Estonia that managed to got a last-minute warning or something like that and actually didn't end up going.
I've never heard of that, but with the Titanic, it's very, very clear that what they did was they got on board their major enemies when it came to the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. They got them on board and got the ship down. There's a lot of around Titanic that is very interesting, I would say.
Oh, sure. They swapped it with the Lusitania and they got out the insurance money for it and everything because it was damaged previously.
I didn't want to go into those details, what I was talking about.
That's right. Whole conspiracy in itself. But nonetheless, back to Estonia.
it just shows you again and again and again, they're pulling these magic tricks in front of our eyes. Yeah, it's trick of illusion. We think one thing is happening, but something totally different is happening behind the scene.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, what more do you want to say about the Estonia and how it ties in? Anything else, loose threads that are hanging around all of this? Do you think we ever will find out who these missing people or the unidentified people were?
Everything will come. I don't know anyone in my profession who wants to give up. I mean, it's just a matter of continuing. And one day it will be revealed, but it can take a long time.
Yeah, it might. Anything else, Ulle, you want to wrap things up on here before we start to round up for this time?
No, just like I said before, everybody has their way of connecting the dots. I'm doing my best. I cannot guarantee that what I say is the absolute truth, but what I can say is that something very, very fishy is going on here, big time, and that it's time to stop this madness. I think the global elite should just say enough is enough and stop messing around with the rest of us.
Well, they won't lay down and die easy, let me tell you.
I don't want them to die. I just want them to stop.
Well, it's been very interesting nonetheless. Thank you for your time and sharing your work so generously with us, Ola. It's very interesting. And you've done a lot of work on this. We have, of course, one more part in the series that we're going to do. And you've indeed left us hanging with a few cliffhangers, if you will. So I'm really looking forward to having some of these resolved and go more into it, Ola. So thank you again for your time. Give us your website again so people know where to go.
It's murderofpalme.com. Murderofpalme.com. And I tell you, the final one, the cliffhanger, that is mind-boggling, mind-blowing.
Very good. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Ola.
Thank you.
Nice of you to listen in today. It's always a pleasure to be able to bring you this information, and we hope that you learn something new. Next on Red Ice Radio, Scott Bartle on the difference between the Australian government and the Commonwealth of Australia. We also have Rudy Matsocki with us to talk about his fiction book, Equity of Evil, that is based on real-life events on the multi-billion dollar black market of human organ transplants. Thank you for being a member. And my special thanks to Frederick, Lorna, and Elizabeth. We'll talk to you next time. In the meantime, take good care.